Welcome to another edition of the Membership World podcast. My name is Gordon Glenister and I'm the founder of Membership World. This edition is sponsored by our friends at RD Mobile, the complete membership events engagement platform. But before we get started, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast just to make sure that you don't miss a future episode. Now, today's episode, I'm talking with Russell Hamblin Boone, who's the CEO of the Civil Enforcement Association, and we're talking all about reputation management for an association. Russell starts by telling me about what it's like working for the Bailiff Association.
Currently, the Civil Enforcement Association that I lead is the membership body for civil enforcement agents who are commonly known as bailiffs. And I represent pretty much the entire market of non-high court enforcement work. So they're the firms that employ people collecting on behalf of local authorities, Transport for London, some government departments, things like council tax arrears and penalty charge notices, child support benefits, business rates, things that the public sector, where people get into arrears and the public sector take people to court. The courts appoint enforcement agents that everyone knows as bailiffs to help recover that debt. One of the challenges that we have as an association is that everyone immediately jumps to their own image of what they think an enforcement agent is. And actually, like all of our jobs, I guess, there's a lot more to it than is portrayed on the television or in the media, or even as politicians understand what we do. I was brought into this job really when the industry recognised, it's a very small industry, and it recognised that it has some reputational issues and that those were only going to get exacerbated when you started to see the impact of austerity in the public sector and also the sort of domestic economy sort of taking a slump, and therefore more people either becoming financially vulnerable, getting themselves into problem debt. And therefore, although it's still a small number of people, more people coming into contact with the enforcement process. And so rather than drawing someone from the industry, and there's lots of people in the industry, sort of born and bred, man and boy, grew up through, bringing someone in with a different set of skills, which are more related to, you know, communications and public affairs and lobbying and reputation management, the stakeholder engagement, all of those type of skills, rather than just someone who really, really knows their industry well and knows everybody in it. And so I think that is often a good thing for trade associations. If you have someone who perhaps has a different set of skill set that you don't have within your membership, or that complements the skill set in your membership, that is also objective and can perhaps ask some of the questions that you don't want to be asked, but can do it because you've engendered a degree of trust by virtue of the fact that they are your trade association representative, and you can have those conversations in a safe space and you can have an honest discussion about what's not right. And then you can move on from that, having acknowledged that you have problems and that there are things to fix, to start thinking about what the solutions might be. I remember when I was being interviewed for the job, and as I've done with other jobs, said, you know, if you're looking for a yes man, someone to agree with everything you do, then, you know, I'm not the right person. If you're looking for someone to challenge what you do and take you forward, then I might be able to help on that path.
And it's a really interesting area, actually, isn't it? Because pretty much all the board members will come from the industry and have a lot of knowledge about things, but they'll also have different opinions and voices. So being a CEO, it can be quite a lonely job at times because everybody's got an opinion on how you should be doing things, not just from an organisational and executive point of view, but also in the wider industry. And that in itself is a challenge, isn't it, sometimes, Russell?
Yeah, I know that very well myself. It is like herding cats, and you do need a sort of a master's in diplomacy and things like that. But I think it's helped me. I suppose I've become almost like a professional trade association person, if there's such a thing, because all of the jobs that I've had in trade associations have been going through some sort of reform, and perhaps trade associations are always on that sort of dynamic path anyway, and that's good and healthy. There's a difference between the trade association changing and evolving in response to circumstances and then having to deal with external circumstances for which it doesn't have any control that it needs to respond to. And I often say, when I look back on my career, I don't know whether the troubles followed me or I've created trouble. I helped set up the Energy Retail Association, which is now Energy UK, and is a great big organisation. Back then, it was a guy from PowerGen, as it was called, and me, a kind of a broom cupboard. And the first job we had was, can we blag some laptops from any of the companies that we represent? And it was then the seven big energy suppliers wanted a trade association set up specific for them. And within a couple of years, we had the first gas price hike since privatization. And so we were dealing with all the issues around, you know, allegations of cartels operating through the association and all that sort of stuff, and people not used to their energy prices going up and fuel poverty and everything else. And similarly, when I went to the Finance and Leasing Association, we had a credit crunch, which we never had since, I don't know, Wall Street or something. My next job was setting up a trade association for this new innovative set of firms that were mostly come from America, bringing a new product to the UK, which became known as payday lending. And the Consumer Finance Association represented high-cost short-term lenders, not entirely from America, but a lot driven by America, that wanted to sort of find a place in the UK market, but didn't know how the UK market operated, how consumers would respond. And you obviously saw it over time go through some difficult things with some sort of quite brash advertising, which goes down well in America, but over here we're a little more uncomfortable about it, right the way through to sort of having to learn how to work with a regulator like the Financial Conduct Authority. So there were lots of challenges in that role as well. So I was probably earned my spurs, I guess, to be able to do something now in as uncontroversial as working with the bailiff industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so what would your sort of some of your tips and advice be for somebody that is facing a potential challenge that hasn't perhaps had something before? I mean, let's just take some of the impact of Brexit, for example. There've been all sorts of issues for industries that didn't have those problems before. What would your advice be on taking those issues forward? Because I think sometimes, whether it's a union, a charity, or a trade body, to show their existence and their value to their members, they sometimes do need a cause. I mean, dare I say it, some unions in the rail industry have shown their value by just going on strike, whether you agree with it or not. But it's a reality that being able to show your members what you're doing on their behalf and being very vocal about that is important.
I mean, the most important thing, I think, is all the preparation that goes before you hit that crisis.
Of course.
So your relationship with your members, that you've got the trust of your members and that your association has credibility and that the membership has sort of stood up to the standards that you want your industry to be meeting, and that externally you've got the relationships in place with decision makers and policy makers in government, in local authorities, in stakeholder groups, in consumer groups, campaign groups, whatever else it is. You may not always have the same position, but at least you can disagree with each other respectfully, so that when those crises come along, they may be the ones chucking rocks at you externally, but you're also able to have conversations with them privately that get you through. Very often campaign groups have to be noisy. You know, their currency is media coverage. They also recognize that that noise doesn't necessarily get them an outcome. The outcome is more likely to be from within. I often feel that I'm a campaigner myself, or at least maybe a reformer, and that rather than being on the outside chucking rocks to try to engender change, I do it from the inside by working with the industries and, you know, maybe more baby steps and a more softly approach to making changes for the better. And sometimes painful changes, but, you know, ultimately long-term good changes. So I think that there's that role about relationships. That's the key thing. And the groundwork you've put in place means that when a crisis hits, you've already got a strong communication channels and you've got a strong level of integrity to be able to have honest conversations about how you're going to resolve things. At the same time, you've also got to have your public-facing role and how you want to present yourself as an industry. And again, that's about preparation. What's the identity of your industry? What is it you want people to think about when they think of you? And, you know, I'm a classic example here. I've talked about it here. We're commonly known as bailiffs, and people immediately jump to, you know, can't pay, we'll take it away, or whatever else it is. So I sometimes think that my role is to try to present a different face, try to sort of shift opinion a little bit and influence people's thinking about what they believe our industry does. And sometimes try to disarm people by being the opposite of what they expect to see when they think about, you know, a guy from the bailiff industry.
And do you see the role of a CEO being the face of the organisation, or do you see that as driven by the chair of the board?
It depends on the association and it depends on the issues. If it's a very technical association, then the chair and the person who's got huge knowledge of the industry and its background and everything else is the best person. My job is not to go into multiple levels of depth in knowledge of the industry. I can't compete with my members in their knowledge of the industry. That's their skill set. My skill set is disseminating that information so that it can be communicated in a way that's understood and accessible to a wider audience, especially an audience that may be opinionated and with opinions based on low level of knowledge. So I've got to compete with that low level of knowledge, add a bit more knowledge and an explanation that goes with it. So I think in those situations, the chief executive who's slightly removed from the commercial element of the industry is the best person to be a spokesperson. And if you've got a chief executive who, you know, like me, has come from different sectors with different knowledge, actually, they will be very skilled at media engagement and doing TV and radio and all of those things in lots of different industries. While we all say, you know, there are some sort of standard skills that you apply when you're doing radio or television, that's true. But also there are lots of things that you learn that are relevant to each sector as well that you bring into play there. I mean, one of the things that I often find myself repeating in different jobs that I've had is that I'm dealing with people who've had very little experience of the issue that they're dealing with, but they've got a very high opinion of it. There's lots of people who've never met a bailiff who feel very strongly about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an interesting point that you raise there, because getting wide opinion from people within the industry collectively agreeing in itself can be a challenge, not least of all from just the board alone. Because if you're going to be producing an outreach communication, you'd want to make sure that even though there might be some dissent or differences of opinion, we've got to go with one clear message that the majority of us go with, because otherwise you'll be dancing around a pin forever and a day, won't you?
Yeah, and that's where you've got to have built a strong degree of trust. Your members have got to trust in you for you to be able to say, look, I'm going to draft the press release. I'm happy for you to see it, but we're not drafting it by committee because that's my job. Another way of putting it is, you know, I create the stage for you and I bring you the audience and it's up to you to do the performing bit. So, you know, when that comes to standards and things like that, I'm the one who will do the communicating of it. What you have to do is fulfill it because I can't do that bit. And I think it's exactly the same in dealing with the media or whatever. I'll take the hit. I'll be the spokesman and I'll communicate the messages. We can agree what those messages are collectively, but how those messages are communicated, that has to be down to the person who's got the role of delivering it.
Have you ever found something as like you see some of the TV interviews, for example, and I've seen a fair few of my friendly trade association bosses appear. Some have done a great job. For example, Ben from the Residential Landlords Association is a good example. Chris Skeeth from the Association of Event Organisers, all done very good jobs during the pandemic and over particular regulations. But have you ever found or come up against situations when, you know, you're putting your best foot forward and the media have decided to take a completely different spin on it, or it's not gone down the way that you'd hoped?
I say you're only ever as good as your last media interview. So if you've done a bad one, you need to correct it pretty quickly. I can say numerous examples of interviews where it's been tough because of the industries I represent, and on certain programs, certain news programs, there is an agenda to make it entertaining and you're there to be the Aunt Sally. And the best you can do then is play for a draw, try and get at least one of your points across and get people going away thinking, maybe I'm not entirely have a strong opinion that I had before I started listening to that bloke. You know, most of the time when it comes to media and things like that, people aren't really listening to what you're saying. They're just listening to how you're saying it. And they'll go away thinking, oh, I quite like that guy, so therefore I don't have such a bad opinion about whatever he was saying.
It's true, though. It's absolutely true. I mean, I was watching Question Time the other evening, last night, actually, and the former Liberal Democrats leader really came across very, very well. And it was because of he got his numbers right. He listened to the other people around the table and was really able to articulate. Well, look, we could talk about this forever and a day, but it's been really great to have an insight into your career and, more importantly, talk about some of the challenges of what it's like being a CEO at the forefront. If anybody wants to find out more about you, how can they do that?
Yeah, my email, CEO@civea.co.uk. And I'm on LinkedIn, happy to connect.
This podcast is sponsored by RD Mobile, providing events and member engagement solutions used by organizations worldwide. RD Mobile can help your organization deliver value at your next virtual or in-person event and throughout the year. Visit us at rdmobile.com to learn more.
That's it for another edition of the Membership World podcast. Thanks again to my sponsor, RD Mobile, and my producer, Neil Whiteside from Freedom One. And until next time, from me, Gordon Glenister, it's bye for now.